Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we are talking about Julian Barrett and Simon Farnaby's detective comedy drama Mindhorn.
Mindhorn.
I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining me is my radio rebus, my broadcasting Bergerac, my podcasting Poirot, Helen Seymour.
Hello.
Hello, mate. I thought you'd like that introduction.
That was amazing. That was very good.
I know you're a big lover of the TV detective.
I love it. Columbo is my favourite.
Unfortunately, I couldn't find a radio podcasty word that began with the like a curse sound.
That's okay.
If you think of one, just shout it later on.
I will.
Helen will not be doing a lot of shouting today, as her voice, as you may have heard, is slightly damaged.
What are you saying, mate?
Sorry, was it a secret?
I think it sounds great.
Sorry, Helen's testing out her new kind of jazzy blues voice. And she just thought this was a good place to experiment.
My mum said, on the phone, oh, no, I think it's nice. You sound more confident.
Oh, no, that's such a bad thing to get told by a parent as well. So yes, it's Mindhorn today, and so this is a film about a TV detective who in the real world is just an actor who is then brought in to a police chase situation to be a real detective again. And it's really, really, really good. It's so good.
It's so good. We both said we haven't laughed. We don't think we've laughed that much. And I was properly laughing.
Yeah.
And I rarely laugh out loud in the cinema.
Yep. I think since from memory, it's the Alan Partridge Alpha Papa film is the last time that I had this many laughs. It's such an achievement of silliness and stupidity, but fiercely clever as well. It's absolutely excellent. And so, to begin, as usual, we've got our podcast pitch. And this week, I'm looking for a pitch for a film that involves a real-life actor becoming the film within a film. And now we watch the film within that film. So, Helen, what have you got for us?
Right, so there's a fireman. And he is making another film. There's a fireman, and he's making another film about another fireman.
Right.
But that fireman is played by a pig.
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. And it goes really well, and the film gets a lot of screen time, and it wins awards. But he's noticing that the pig isn't being invited to all the award ceremonies. He's getting left off a lot of guest lists, and he's really angry about this because he had a really good working relationship with that pig, and he feels like the pig is being let down.
Is this a bit like Uggy the dog from The Artist not getting Best Actor?
It's exactly like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So what he does is he thinks, I'm going to prove to the world that this pig is worth something.
I'm sure it is.
So he sets up a fire where he is the victim because he is sure that the pig will come and save him. Unfortunately for him, he really was just a pig all along. So the guy dies.
Wow, that's bleak. That's almost, that's Kaufman-y as well. There's bits of adaptation in there, bits of Synecdoche, New York.
Want to know the title?
I would love to know it.
Fireman Ham.
Oh, it's just a setup. But I'm okay with it, you know? I mean, normally when we do these pitches, there's like points are awarded for, you know what? I think that could happen. I don't think there'll be many points for Fireman Ham for, you know what? I think that might exist. But just in pun points, there's a lot there.
Thank you, Jake.
All right. I like it a lot. You know what? It could happen.
I think it could. I could make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah,
anyone there's a pig.
I mean, I reckon Garth Jennings for that one.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. Yeah. There's a pig in Sing.
Exactly.
So maybe we could use that one.
Could be the same pig.
It could be, yeah.
That pig in that is like a mother of about 20.
Yeah, so it could be one of Georgian even.
Yeah, and then you flash back and find the mother just like distraught.
Yeah.
Really make the sequel to Sing is just going to be bleak.
Yeah.
Postman Ham, a.k.a. Sing 2.
Postman Ham.
I was thinking Postman Pat. That could be the next one. She's got loads of kids. It could be any of these pigs. Postman Ham, Fireman Ham. We could have Ham Howlett for our departed podcast host, Sam.
I would prefer Ham Howlett.
Well, he is a bit of a pig, isn't he?
Hey!
My pitch for this week is a film that I'm referring to as Christian Light.
Wow.
And this is about the unseen relationship. We've only been given a few minutes portion of this relationship in our world, and I want to expand on that. The relationship between Christian Bale and the lighting guy on Terminator Salvation. Because I was listening to Christian Bale's rant on set of that, where he's like, you and me, we're done professionally, man. Oh, whoop-dee-doop-dee-doo. And it's amazing. I forgot how good it is. And the fact that... And he's just in this mania about this one lighting guy. And what I want to see... Because he's talking to him like, you and me were done professionally, man. Makes me think they've been working together for years.
Oh, yeah.
That this is actually... Like, we have not just seen him going off on one on a runner, on a assistant. This guy, Christian and Light, have been together for years. And
is he called Light?
Yeah, let's call him Light. And I think their relationship is actually like the Treehouse of Horror episode of The Simpsons where Bart has an evil twin.
I know that one.
Yeah.
It's a strong episode.
And they lock the evil twin in the attic.
Mm.
But then at the end of the episode, you find out that the evil twin is actually the nice one.
Yeah.
And Bart is the evil one and should be locked in the attic. And so I think they've got this dynamic going on. We know that Christian Bale, he's used twins before in The Prestige.
Mm.
I reckon him and Light are twins who work together for years, one of them just lighting the other. That's like Christian Bale is super famous, superstar, and his twin brother has spent his whole career lighting him. That's it.
Wow.
And think of that, and he's had to deal with that fame in his brother, and he's getting all he's doing is making him more famous by lighting him. And then one day Bale just snaps, and we see what Light does afterwards. Christian Light.
You get the point on that.
Yeah.
I genuinely want to see that.
Yeah. I reckon we could get Bale because Bale definitely thinks of himself as like a pretty serious guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rightly so, Jake.
And I could try and convince him to do the Joaquin Phoenix thing when he did the fake documentary and get him to do this.
You've actually got an angle. You've got an in.
Yeah. So Christian Bale's agent, if you are listening, I mean, he's not Batman anymore. What's he doing? Like, he's and he won't even have to do a dramatic weight change for this one. Like, he can just be himself, you know?
It is strong. You convinced me.
Great. Well, there we are. Christian Light and Fireman Ham, both coming soon. Onwards to Mindhorn. And we spoke briefly about what this film is about, but I actually went to meet Julian Barrett and Simon Farnaby to talk about it, and as I got in the room, they were asking themselves what the film was actually about. So rather than us explain it, why not let them?
How would you explain it?
We've tried many times.
We can't do
it's
it.
It's quite hard. Should we try one?
No, it is.
Should we try one? And then you can cut it out if you need it. You can
go on. Try and explain what Mindhorn is.
Right.
Mindhorn is a story about an actor called Richard Thorncroft who used to be in a TV show called Mindhorn, a detective show.
Set on the Isle of Man.
Set on the Isle of Man. It was sort of a cross between Bergerac and $6 Million Man. Our film starts sort of 25 years later, and the police on the Isle of Man are looking for a suspect in a murder case, and he calls the police and he says, "I'll hand myself in, but only if I can talk to Detective Mindhorn." And they go, "Isn't that a TV show?" And he goes, "Get me Mindhorn!" So he thinks Mindhorn is real. They have no other leads, so they get in touch with the actor who used to play Mindhorn, and played by Julian,
by myself,
who is a washed-up, sort of overweight, balding. You know, his career's gone off the rails. So he sees this call as an opportunity to get his career back on track, get back into the limelight, and it all goes a bit wrong.
That's the pitch.
I mean, that was about a minute and a half, wasn't it?
I can tell you it was exactly one. No, it was about, yeah, it was about a minute and 15. That's why it took us 10 years to get the film made. Yeah.
There's sort of this theory to go, if you can't explain the film in under 6 words, it's doomed, it's finished, it's dead.
But you could say, but fictional hero mistaken for real hero.
I like it. We could have had it made years ago if we'd just done it.
Yeah,
that's true, actually. That's the log line, isn't it? Mm.
And in the development of it, was Mindhorn always the show within the show? Were you ever tempted to make just...
The show.
Just the show.
Not really. I mean, we talked about it initially. We liked, that's what we love, that sort of thing. We thought, could we do this? Could we make a sort of just a parody of one of these shows? But it is sort of... When you look at YouTube and you watch them, they're sort of pretty funny on their own. And you sort of think... Is there any point in making another one of these?
Exactly, because that's the funny thing, is that you know, if you know it's a fiction, it's made up, it's more difficult to sort of laugh at it, because you're going, they've deliberately done it wrong, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Whereas...
There's a way, I'm sure there is a way of doing it. I mean, I don't... If you're subtle with the joke somehow, and you're weaving in a sort of external narrative to the actual thing, but that's... It's hard to do without breaking reality of the piece. And so... We sort of quite soon, Simon had this idea of this phone call, which suddenly meant that you could have a show set in the past, and then, but it's told from the point of view of this guy, where he is now, and how he relates to the show he made, and how he relates to his past, and then how you how he tries to get himself back in the game, and so it became about him, and I think, and we suddenly felt like, oh, this is much more of a. You believe in the character, you feel for him, and you go through his pain and enjoy him having quite a lot of pain as well, because he's deserving of it. But rather than a thing you're watching and going, oh, that's a clever that's a clever thing they did there, they really got that right, which you can only do for, you can't, I don't even do that for 2 hours, can you?
Sort of no. But we thought if we could make the actor funny and a rounded sort of character, and Julian's a very funny performer, and so you go, if we can crack that aspect, then the show will be a sort of side salad. Not a side salad, a side dessert. You have side desserts?
Not during the main course, no.
Like Quality Street with you, steak?
It could be.
Well, if you did do that, that's what it would.
Yeah.
But it's like
meal, but...
You sort of, you're enjoying the steak.
Would you like some Quality Street?
With your beef, enjoying the steak.
Well, how many
But you'd go... you go, ooh, look, there's a nice sort of strawberry quality. I'll have that. Yeah, but then I'll get back to the steak, because this is what I'm really here to eat.
Yeah. Or a side of potatoes.
Rather than making the quality street the main, the bits of the mind on show.
Like a 2-hour quality
you'd street. You'd be sick.
That's it. Yeah. You'd have diabetes. So too much of the exact parody is like getting diabetes after eating too much chocolate.
And Richard is the beef.
A very nice cut of beef.
Yes.
Get drunk on that beef.
Exactly.
And so, did you know straight away that you were going to be Mindhall?
I knew even before Simon had come up with the idea.
Really?
No, I didn't. We sort of... Simon initially said you should do this, be this chap. So I said, maybe... but why don't we sort of write it and not think about who's in it and just write it as a thing and see what happens, and maybe we can get a big actor to do it, someone who's known for Gravitas and and has a history in that genre or something, or maybe he played a Kenneth detective Branagh. Or Suchet or one of those guys. One of those, the big dogs. But we...
big cheeses.
Yeah, the big cheese dogs. But we sort of thought, eventually, I've been doing the voice... and sort of, it wasn't that different to my voice, but I've been doing it for 48 years, so I thought I've got the hang of it. I sort of realised I could do the character, and then it became a sort of fait accompli, I suppose, whatever we
it was always a chance. It was always Julian for me, because there's always a chance you would get an actor and they would just do it all wrong, because you'd have to offer it. That's how it works. You get a sort of star and they'd turn up and it'd be all wrong and they'd not very funny or something.
Yeah. Usually they go, will they come in to read? And they're only if you give them the part. But what if they're not very good? They're not coming in unless you give them it.
They're not coming in unless you...
Usually you meet them then, and then they go, well, why didn't you get me in? I would have loved to have done it. Well, you know, you heard them. They say, no. And then it's their agents said that, usually.
Yeah.
And crafting, like, the identity of Mindhorn, even down to the outfits and the eye patch.
Yeah,
because I was listening to Adam Buxton, and he talked in there about at some point it was a nose that could smell through.
Yeah, initially we had that as an idea. There was lots of variations on the body part that could sense criminality or could sense, tremors in the force. So it was a nose at one point, yes, but not for long, only for an afternoon.
For about 20 minutes.
Yeah, and I think the eye patch is good. I look good in an eye patch.
Yeah.
And you do only you like to act with one eye anyway.
Two eyes from I can knock people over with.
It's too powerful. You need to block out some of his rays.
I was wondering whether this was a subconscious way of taking the small eyes joke from the Boosh and giving yourself a super powered eye to combat.
Thank you. That's not the intention, but I'll take that on board and repeat that as if I'd thought of it. But I think it's a little bit like, as an actor, it's like I feel as though because I have such a power as an actor, I just wanted to give myself a handicap. A little bit like tying my arm behind my back.
Oh, to give everyone else just a better chance.
Exactly, in the film.
Because John Nettles and Ian McShane are all going to sit and watch this and go, come on.
They're all binocular actors. Whereas I'm...
A monocular.
Monocular, I've got...
He's the best monocular actor I've ever seen. Mm. Him and Kurt Russell. There's not many of them, but you are one of them.
Well, it was nice to think of all the stuff that he could wear and what would be a great idea for an 80s action hero, and... thinking about Escape from New York and all those big action movies, and the look, the macho look. How can we make that into a bit more of a sort of private detective or a detective on the police force, or plainclothes detective version of one of these heroes? What would he wear? And what would his skill be? And how would his origin? It's all stuff. Mm. That's just like it's fun to think of all that stuff.
Yeah, that was fun.
Well, I mean, he's almost, even in the show in the 80s, he's dressed like a cop from the 70s as well.
Yes, I mean, he's out of date even then. And the thing about the 80s is it's full of stuff from the 70s and 60s and all the clothes and everything. So it's a mistake some people make is they try and make everything from 1983, if it's filmed in 1983. But of course, in 1983, a lot of people were not up to date
It was still hangovers from the 70s.
But also we picked and chose from various stuff as well. We weren't trying to be so specifically accurate about the time. We were within a certain ballpark. We thought we'll have a bit of that and that.
Because Windjammer, this sort of the idea of just a boring bloke in a coat, it was quite later, isn't it? It's sort of that's along the sort of Wycliffe kind of Frost. Lewis, when the detectives went, let's not have any exciting ones with leather jackets, let's have really boring ones with like trilbies, and they go, oh, well, excuse me one moment.
I suppose Columbo's a version of that, although he had a glass eye. He did have the
but wasn't that the actor that had a glass eye?
Yes, it was great casting.
Who the hell are we going to get to play this glass eyed detective? I think Peter Falk is free. I really hope so, because he's the only one.
And I imagine you probably had a good time making up all of the Mindhorn merchandise.
Yeah, we did. I mean, Peter Francis, our art director, ran with all our ideas. But we loved the idea of, it's quite, not inappropriate, but like things really like a geometry set.
Yeah,
you know, like a Mindhorn compass and rulers,
driving gloves,
gear stick,
embroidered gear stick, warmer, sunglasses case, sun visor,
sun visor sticker.
One thing that I can't forget whilst I'm here is Helen, who was originally going to do this interview, she's actually performing her one-woman show tonight and couldn't make it, and so for some anxiety therapy did a watercolour of Mindhorn. And I was wondering if I could get you to compare the likeness and go have a look at this wonderful painting.
Oh yes.
It's very nice.
She's captured the intensity of that visible
of
eye.
The monocle.
The monocular powerhouse that is
very. The nose is like very. She's sort of Liam Neeson. There's a bit of Neeson in there.
Yes.
Neesonified it.
Yes, at least Liam.
I have a set of skills. One eye.
Right.
But it's very good.
It's exceptional.
Nice.
Yeah.
Particularly where
the paint on the red eye has actually bled through and had to be sellotaped from the back.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
It's a good touch, isn't it?
Mm.
And as I grew up in Hastings, which is a big May Day culture there, so there's a particular scene with a parade here, which I was very attached to, and I was wondering whether there was any particularly disturbing childhood memories that were raised for yourselves.
Oh, well, God, yeah.
Parades.
There was a parade in Richmond where when I was young. There was always some crummy parade. And it'd be every year, and you'd always have to do something slightly embarrassing on a really slow... Things about parade is so slow.
Mm.
If it went quite fast, you'd go, oh, great, I'm dressed as a scarecrow, you know, I'm a Wurzel Gummidge. I'm a Wurzel Gummidge themed float.
Yeah.
No one knows why this is happening.
No.
But I've got straw in my hair, and my face is painted.
Yeah.
And Aunt Sally's next to me. And I wish it could go a bit faster. But it doesn't. It's just a slow, torturous...
Oh, God, you see them. I mean, you still see these things. Like, a float goes past, and there'd be like seven sort of 14-year-old boys from the local karate club. Just completely red with embarrassment.
Yeah,
the moves.
Yeah, really flushed. But their sensei's going, come on, come on, keep it up! Nice run. Jonathan, pick it up! Come on, don't look at them. Do the moves. Yeah. Yes, the parade culture.
Yeah, and that was a real parade in the Isle of Man. We hijacked it. We filmed and coincided the filming with it.
Yeah,
so that you could have the sort of sense of that sense of kind of washed out British fun.
It worked very nicely. We always had that idea of a parade and some lookalike Mindhorns and the police chasing them and having to spin them around and finding that they're just, you know, fake Mindhorns. I think it's worked quite well, that bit.
Yeah, it certainly did. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There we are, the fantastic Julian Barrett and Simon Farnaby on great form there. I'm sure they could have quite happily sat for about 2 hours. They clearly just, they just feel like they're best friends.
It's
and
really...
like we've got in the way of them just having a nice time by having to interview them.
Mm, definitely. You did get in the way.
Yeah, I like to imagine that they just booked that room to just sit there and chat. And then PR company was just like, guys, seeing as you're here, can you let some journalists come in and talk to
you?
They
were kind enough.
It's like, oh, we booked this room privately. This was our chat time.
I bet they do have scheduled chat time.
Yeah. And they enjoyed your painting.
Which I'm really proud of.
Yeah.
It took me a whole 25 minutes.
I think it looked like...
Done a watercolour.
I think it looked like more. More like 25 minutes.
I was quite happy with it.
Yeah, it's a lovely, lovely painting. Did you take a picture of it?
No.
What? Because I didn't take a picture of it because I thought you would have documented it.
It's ephemeral.
Okay. Okay, so for the listeners and for us, it lives in memory. And for Julian Barrett, it lives in fact because he has it.
I mean, I imagine...
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
It's framed by now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the interview was 2 days ago, so... Yeah. Like, that's definitely hanging above his fireplace.
No, his bed.
Yeah, definitely. Or next to his mirror in the morning, yeah. Like a Mindhorn picture. Yeah. You are exactly where you need to be, looking at the painting that you did for him.
Let's nail this, mother.
Right, so, Mindhorn. We said earlier, it's great. It's so good. So, let's set the scene. Mindhorn is back on the Isle of Man. He's got to solve a crime because the Kestrel, played by Russell Tovey, has supposedly killed someone and Mindhorn needs to save the day. And everyone is just on top form. We've got, along with Simon Farnaby as Clive Parnovic, who is Mindhorn's ex-stuntman. We've got Julian Barrett, obviously, as Richard Thorncroft, the actor, and Mindhorn himself. Along the way, we've got Essie Davis, who you might know from The Babadook, as Patricia DeVille, who was the love interest in Mindhorn the show, and also the love interest here. Who'd have guessed? We've got Andrea Riseborough, Kenneth Branagh, Steve Coogan as Peter Eastman, a.k.a. Windjammer.
Didn't get in this industry to sell cagoules.
That's a spin-off show from Mindhorn. We've got Russell Tovey as the Kestrel, Harriet Walker, who's just in the sense of an ending, as Richard's agent, Jessica Barden as a daughter character, which we'll get into later, Simon Callow as Simon Callow. Just so much going on, everyone turning up and everyone just having a good time.
There's literally no weak link on this, and there's no one that I didn't enjoy watching.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a number of... I think we do go on a classic journey with Richard, and I think he's kind of set up in a modern British tradition of the David Brents and Alan Partridges and a bit of Father Ted as well, in that they're not heroes, they're not anti-heroes, but ultimately we are still on their side.
They're very likable.
Mm.
Let me just switch tone. He's very likable. And he's quite lonely.
Yeah.
In a really kind of like recognisable way, in this way of he's been really, really famous and he had this great thing. And then there's a great shot. It's really early on, but you just see him without his wig on that he uses, and he just looks really tired.
Yeah.
And that's all you need from the shot just to understand where he is in his life right now.
Yeah. Because the film begins with this brilliantly 80s clip from Mindhorn, the show as it was. And was he in the army or a policeman?
I think possibly both.
and got into an accident and ended up having one of his eyes transplanted to have a bionic eye put in that could literally see truth, which is wonderfully stupid.
So he wears an eye patch,
yeah,
and has a red centre in the middle, which I imagine is the bit that sees the truth.
and we see how Mindhorn the show looked, and then we come out of it and we meet Thorncroft now, and it's a one-bedroom studio flat. It's dirty, it's dingy, and when he goes to the bathroom, he opens the cupboard, and in there he's got Mindhorn merchandise. And I think, and he's still convinced that this is fine.
Yeah. I think he's delusional.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
He's telling himself that he'll just come on. He'll get on back. He'll get back on track. We'll be okay. I'm Mindhorn. I know the truth.
And at this point, he's advertising orthopedic socks. And we go to meet his agent, and we find Simon Callow in there. And there's some wonderful exchanges between Callow and the agent and Richard all at once. That just, in the way that you imagine... you like to imagine awful celebrities greet each other, that they're all very smiley and they're happy, and within a few minutes they're effing and blinding at each other because they hate each other so much because they might steal apart.
Yeah. And oh yes, I can't remember your name, but you were fantastic.
Yes, I don't remember. Yeah. Oh god, just brilliant. And yeah, Callow does that very well. And then following that, we have an audition with Kenneth Branagh that is horrible to watch. And that's, I think at the start of the film, we're meeting Thorncroft at his very worst, at his most impersonable and most un-PC, particularly established by the nature of the character he's auditioning for.
Yeah. And he's just really lost the plot.
Yeah. But Branagh, I almost think Branagh is breaking character at this point, because Julian Barrett is having to do an audition as an out-of-work aging actor who is auditioning for the role in which you see outside is completely made up of black men. So he's turned up to the wrong audition, but then goes for it anyway and puts on the most awful accent for no reason.
No.
And Branagh is trying to deal with this, and you're almost expecting Branagh to look into the camera.
Yeah. I really hope that Branagh didn't really know what he was going to do and he just did it in one take.
Yeah. Oh, well, speaking of Branagh, photo came up this week of him doing Poirot.
No way.
Yeah, Murder on the Orient Express.
Hey.
Yeah, he looks remarkably like Ewan McGregor in it, which is weird because I got very confused because he's got the great Poirot tash, and then Johnny Depp is in it as well with a tash, and I thought, have they accidentally made a sequel to Mordecai? but luckily they haven't. But there's the Branagh tash.
Wow.
As Poirot.
Now, I mean, that's great for the listeners, Jake.
Yeah, I know. But I was going to show you. You are a Poirot fan.
It's,
what do you make of Branagh as Poirot?
I think that is a strong choice. That is brilliant. I'm excited for that. That's a brilliant tash. Yeah. Guys, look at it. It'll make your morning.
Yeah.
Or afternoon.
Sadly, no Branagh tash in this, but a very lovely scene at least. And he does very well. And then it's not. It's kind of got that. There is a sense in modern British comedies that there is a bit of a roll call for cameos as well. And we've seen this. We see this all the time. Maybe it's just because the country's so much smaller than America. It's just a bit easier that someone's doing a comedy. Steve, Ken, whoever. Can anyone just make it down?
Yeah.
Just turn up for a bit. And so we end up with Steve Coogan, who we meet briefly. And I think Steve Coogan's character, who is Peter Eastman, who was the character of Windjammer, who was on the show Mindhorn. And after Richard left to go to LA to find fame, which he didn't, Windjammer was given his own spin-off show, which was now running for 16 years. And he was the most successful out of anyone to come out of Mindhorn. And I think that Peter Eastman is ultimately what Alan Partridge wants to be.
It's so true.
Yeah, because Partridge was the minor character on the day-to-day. And then with each iteration of Partridge, he thought he was getting bigger and bigger. And I thought this was a great way for Coogan to be like, if Partridge had everything, every decision went his way, it would end up being Windjammer.
And he would live in a house with oil paintings of cagoules all over the walls.
And in the interview, they do talk about how there was this change in the way that detectives dressed, and Windjammer is the modern, cool detective, and it's not about having fun outfits anymore. It's you've got to be pretty plain. You've got to be straight and narrow, line of duty kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so the identifying feature of Windjammer is he wears a cagoule.
Yeah.
And then you look at Mindhorn, and he's from the 80s. As we said in the interview, he's dressed like he's from the 70s. He's got the roll neck jumper and mustard leather jacket that are horrible and far too small. The wig, the eye patch. This is a man with identity. Right, so that's kind of the key players here. And then we have Russell Tovey, who kickstarts the plot by saying that there's been a murder on the Isle of Man, which is where Mindhorn was filmed and where it took place. And that's why he wants Mindhorn to come back to the Isle of Man to help solve this crime. And Tovey is the Kestrel, and he's very good in this. I was a bit hesitant when I saw the trailers because I thought he was just going to be over the top with it. Not that that's wrong in this position, but he's meant to be a kid that was a bit damaged and sought refuge in Mindhorn, and I thought it was going to be like a real version of Syndrome from The Incredibles or something. Mm. But he actually turns out he's actually quite sweet.
He's very sweet. Yeah. And I don't think they're really mocking him in the way they built his character.
Mm.
This is what's so good about this show, is there's so much heart in it.
Mm.
And even when there's slightly odd characters, it's never in a mean way that they're making it.
Mm.
And I think that's what a lot of comedy doesn't do, is they go on quite a harsh line and they sort of like take the mic and they're making fun of people. Whereas this, everyone's got so much quirk and so much that's a bit, you know, off kilter, that actually it's a really joyful celebration. And I do think that that's really Bushy as well.
Mm.
So anyone that sort of liked that vibe that comes from the Mighty Bush of just a lot of joy and silliness, I think will really enjoy this film. It absolutely does stand in its own right, though. It's not kind of like a...
It's not as zany.
Yeah, and it's got its own, you know, its own identity beyond that. But I think that vibe is very strong in this, and that's what I really enjoy about it, because I don't think comedy has to be mean, and I don't think they make Russell Tovey look mean. Like, they call him the Kestrel, and he's silly, but like you say, he's really sweet, and actually, as you go on the film, you really root for him.
Mm. Yeah, and he's a fan of the show. And that's why he rings up Mindhorn, and he's got all the memorabilia. And this could be done in a creepy way as well, but it's just so loving. And I think Julian Barrett and Simon Farnaby are clearly fans of these. They are fans of Bergerac, and they are fans of these TV shows. And there is some of them in the Kestrel.
Exactly.
And I think they're... we've had stuff like, I don't know, like the Big Bang Theory that's meant to be destigmatizing the character of the nerd. But, I mean, that's like taking... like big superheroes and Indiana Jones and Star Wars, which are multi-billion dollar franchises, and saying, you know what, these things are okay. I mean, yeah, everyone's decided they're okay. That's not exactly that big of a step. Whereas saying this pretty bad, quite camp show from the 80s, which you've spent thousands of pounds on effect, like pointless little things that just make you happy, that's great, that's fine.
That's what I mean, like, they're not making fun of him for doing that. Like, I imagine that, and like, I really enjoy that thing of like, I've been a sucker for merchandise before when I just really like something, because it just makes me happy, and I think that's good. And there are so many kind of shows like that that that, like you say, that they're not big, and people go through phases of liking things or not. And I love that the Kestrel just is still like, Mindhorn hasn't been on for ages, and he doesn't watch Windjammer, I don't think. He's not interested in that. It's all about Mindhorn. And there's even at one point there's a book of kind of tips from Mindhorn that he refers to. So, well, it's in the book, so you know, that's what I did. And I think there's Richard sort of looks through the book, and there's a look of like, oh, someone did actually buy this, like, of happiness with that, which is really lovely.
I just want to talk about the kind of the Britishness of the Isle
and the Kestrel, even to call him the Kestrel.
I think if this is not like Bond or something,
no,
like where you would if you were making an animal comparison, it's going to be a cheetah or a shark or something, like an eagle, like, and this is Kestrel, which is lovely. So this is all set on the Isle of Man, as we said, and I wanted to talk about this in the interview, but sadly we were cut a bit short. The Isle of Man is used as a filming location so much. Like, it's like so many films and TV shows are actually shot on the Isle of Man, because it's a beautiful place, and it's easy to get to. It's relatively cheap to film there, and you can, because of its geography, there's a lot of different locations in it. So you can go from a town to the country to a beach in a very, very short space of time. So if you have a number of different locations, then you can cover that ground really quickly. And you can go to a number of different beaches. You could get a sand beach, you can get a pebble beach. You can mix it all up on the Isle. And so it's really popular to film there, but it's barely ever credited. And I love that this is... it just is really pro Isle of Man. And it's just everything, and that's never mentioned as well. It's like, why are we on the Isle of Man? That's not a thing. No. It's just like assumed, well, it's on the Isle of Man. You just go there. Like, that's where things happen. Why wouldn't you go? And I thought that was really great. And the island's nature, I think it's used in, it made me think a lot about Father Ted. In the way that they're, and the Wicker Man as well, there's this intensification of Englishness. Not Englishness, obviously Father Ted is Irish, but
even
kind of cultural identity.
And the rural, and that isolation.
And that, I think, really, that makes you understand kind of how the Kestrel has come into form and how Mindhorn exists as well through that isolation. You've got no one to tell you that you're wrong, really. And so because he was big in this small culture, he thinks that's reflective of the entire world. That because the Isle of Man loved Mindhorn, everyone loved Mindhorn. And there is this parade, which is the most wonderfully quaint parade, that is caught up in the middle of a chase. And there is a chap commenting throughout this parade, And that may be my favourite moment in the whole thing.
I agree. It's so funny. Like, I almost don't want to talk about it too much because it's such a treat.
Yeah.
But it's... And like we were saying, we were laughing sort of constantly all the way through. And I listened to an interview with them both where they were saying, and Julian in particular was saying, that, you know, you write it and you think it's funny and then you film it and you still think it's funny, but not quite as funny as you first did it because the jokes are being getting a bit old to you now. And then it goes through the edit and you start to think, oh, no. Oh, is this funny? And then you're starting to sort of, you know, really get the finished thing and you think, oh, gosh, this isn't funny at all. And it took for them to, or for him to watch it with an audience to be like, oh, yeah, this is funny. This is fresh to everyone. And I think that in a lot of comedies, that's why they can sometimes seem, especially with film, a bit disjointed, because I think people might start to lose confidence and start to try and change things up a bit, which in the room of filming seems funny because it's new to the crew. Like, you're five takes in and someone does it differently and then that's funny to the crew. That's the one that gets the cut. But in the narrative of the film, it doesn't follow suit. So sometimes jokes can be lost when you're in the audience because it was funny to all the filmmakers who were starting to sort of think, oh gosh, we've heard this before, I'm not sure. And I think that's what's so good about this, is that that's what it is. They've just had faith in their own writing, and the writing is so strong, no matter how silly it is, and it's joyful and silly, but it's clever, like you said, and yes, there are great moments of falling over and stuff, but the writing and the editing is so on point, and the parade is just such the epitome of that, where I can imagine, you know, that it's so funny on paper, but then they could have ruined that so easily by just overdoing it a little bit or bringing one's level up, and they don't, and it's so good.
It's exactly right, and it makes me think there's another film out at the moment which I do really enjoy, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, but that is almost the opposite of that, in that they establish their jokes in the first one and they know what people liked. And it's almost like every character is given the same joke, which I'm happy to hear the same joke again, but then given another one of the same thing. It's almost like every character has one too many jokes and they don't quite know where to cut everyone off, because you need that limit to want more, where it's like as soon as you're given as much as you want, you feel full and you don't have that anticipation. And as Farnaby said in the interview, you want your strawberry cream quality treat to go alongside your steak.
Which is a great...
And there is one thing that I don't think really works, and there is a subplot that's running throughout of that maybe Thorncroft has fathered a daughter. And it kind of comes in out of nowhere, and when it's happening, I feel like, oh, it's a bit of a surprise. I don't really think it's needed, but it will pay off later on, and I don't really think it pays off either.
Yeah, I think that's the one bit that just felt a little bit overwritten, maybe, because I don't think it needs it.
Yeah, I think they got caught up in the idea of having a narrative. Like a traditional narrative that needs this structure and that needs that empathy and full rounded character, and that was an easy way of kind of getting that in there, and it doesn't really work for me. But there is so much other stuff, and the daughter thing isn't given a lot of screen time,
no,
thankfully.
And I really like touches like his stuntman is now the one that ended up with his on-screen lover, and there's wonderful moments from Simon Farnaby in some denim shorts with some what are they called, the big garden scissors,
shears.
He can really work a pair of shears,
and he's really not hiding the fact that his Dutch accent is terrible. Like, that's...
I thought it was like a mock South African. Is it meant to be Dutch?
I thought it was Dutch, but I think, like, again, that's in the same way that your other players in something like a Bond film would just be like, We don't know where they're from, but foreign equals evil.
Right, like, yeah.
That's generally what it counts. Oh, funny accent.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't trust him. That I think that's what...
Which is not good.
Yeah, but I think that's what this is playing off of.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
No, because... Yeah.
Just to clarify.
And that's done really well. We haven't talked about Simon Farnaby compared to Barrett, but obviously they are the two that wrote this thing together. Though Barrett gets more of the screen time, he gets the more fun role. As a collaborative piece, it really is brilliant. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what Farnaby's next work is, because his next writing credit is Paddington 2.
Oh,
which I really cannot wait for.
Yeah.
And I know he's in it, so hopefully we can expect a Barrett appearance. And I'm sure it can be arranged somehow. But I'm so excited for Paddington 2. We're not really going to do any spoiler coverage on here, because there's not many huge plot points that we need to worry about. It's more about just going along for the ride with Mindhorn and engaging with the stupidity and silliness. And just really enjoy it. I can't recommend it enough. If you do anything this week, do go and see Mindhorn. Make that the top priority.
You won't regret it.
You certainly will not regret it. Get me Mindhorn. So before Helen's voice finally does go, make sure you check out Curzon Home Cinema this week. Heal the Living, which was the focus of last week's podcast, is on there. There's an entire collection of films chosen by the director Catel Calavere, so do go and check that out. And The Happiest Day in the Life of Ollie Mackey. We recently interviewed the director of that on the Curzon blog. So if you want to, do go and check that film out on Curzon Home Cinema and read the interview too. But until next time, from my podcasting Poirot, it is goodbye.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Thank you to CSR for letting us use their studio. Till you next time. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.